If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Brian Koberger.
What if the most chilling part of the Brian Koberger case isn't the night of the murders, but everything that happened before? The lurking, the watching, the plotting. With the floodgates now open on hundreds of newly unsealed documents, a fuller picture is emerging, one that paints Koberger not as a man who snapped, but as a patient predator who had been circling his target for weeks, maybe even months. We're talking about Kaylee Gonsalves saying she felt watched while walking her dog, a broken door hinge loose days before the murders, roommates hearing strange noises, glimpses of a shadowy figure near the house. Then there's a possibility, stronger now than ever, that Koberger may have physically entered the home before the attack. Not to kill, but to understand, to memorize the layout, to prepare. That is stalking behavior that goes beyond online obsession. This is old school, standing outside a window, watching, waiting, maybe fantasizing. And when the fantasy couldn't hold the weight of his frustration anymore, the brutality exploded. Robin Dreeke, retired FBI special agent and former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Unit, is here with us again to help us make sense of this deepening timeline, what we now know, what it suggests about Koberger's pre-crime mindset, and why his apparent sloppiness might actually be the result of rage, not a lack of planning. Because this wasn't a man who just picked a house at random. This was a man who studied, who fantasized, and who, when the moment didn't go exactly as planned, may have lashed out with the kind of ferocity we've only just begun to understand. New information has come out in the case against Brian Koberger. This from the unsealing of many, many documents, the police reports coming out, and there's a lot more to come. It's basically just a matter of how quickly can they get this information into a public forum that's adaptable to be consumed. Some of the pieces that have come out are very interesting, and I think it almost challenges a little bit the idea that Koberger just happened to decide on that house that night. There's reports from Kaylee Gonsalves that she thought she was being watched while walking her dog. Other roommates hearing noises, seeing a shadowy figure nearby the house leading up to this. There's other things as well that we can get into. Do you think it was Koberger? Do you think this was part of his stalking that they, I mean, obviously we knew he went by the house all those times. We don't know what else he did, but I'd be very curious if he entered that house prior to this actually taking place and had a bit of an idea of its layout. They had a door that was broken that got off its hinges, literally, like 9 days before all this went down.
I think there's a good possibility of it. As human beings, matter of fact, every time a tragedy like this happens, and I'm doing some news thing other than yours, you know, one of the things that cops always ask the public to do is be diligent. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times what I'll do is I'll try to define for people what diligence looks like. And what diligence looks like is, hey, everyone pay attention to what the baseline normal is around you. So that when something deviates from that baseline, you're going to say, hey, that's a little different, and you pay attention. Because as human beings, we can get that what I call the spider sense or tremors in the force or when something looks different. And so what we're seeing with some of the reporting we're seeing is that the girls were seeing some tremors in the force, some deviations from that normal mm-hmm. look like. So something or someone was causing that deviation that gave them a little bit of a creepy off feeling. Mm-hmm. Could have been Koberger. Yes, no doubt. Could have been other creepy people. Yeah, because there's a lot of creepy people in the world, especially if you have a house that's got high traffic in the area. Yeah. So it could be a lot of things, but I would not rule out that it could have been Koberger, especially since, and I'm still holding with this, you know, he went to Idaho to murder. That was part of what he wanted to do because he bought the knife before he went out there. I think it was in his mind that he was going to do some sort of crime like this. Mm-hmm. Part of the next phase of that was identifying victims and identifying location. I think he was collecting data points on both simultaneously. I think the venue itself created an opportunity because it was so open, because it had high traffic area, because it represented, if his symbology comes in at all, represented the things he couldn't have, and that is being included with people that liked each other. Mm-hmm. Then you also had the girls.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you know, well-liked, well out there, and also, you know, up in the room where you could see, not Maddie, it was it Maddie?
Maddie. Yeah,
by her window. So
which is alluded to a lot in that new the James Patterson book.
Right.
That he would sit outside the window. I mean, this is the conjecture of Patterson that he would sit outside that window and watch her. And I believe it. That makes total sense. It also makes more sense too of this amping up in behavior where he finally did go into the house where. We don't have anything. There's no evidence that he was on social media following them or anything. One would think at this day and age that, you know, if you got a thing for the girl, and obviously it's more than a thing, this was obsessive stalking, but if you're the obsessive stalker, you'd be on their social media. You'd be looking at the mm-hmm. pictures of them. I mean, I guess one could say, you know, maybe he was and it was just erased and he wasn't necessarily following. There may have been that. I mean, there's ways I'm sure one could do that and really never show up in a history. So I would wonder if that existed, but he certainly wasn't following them. But I think it was more physicality for Koberger. I think that looking in that window, that old way of being creepy, you know, old school creep rather than new school creep online. He was following that and he's sitting there and he's watching and he's fantasizing every day. And this is how he's consuming that fantasy of his. And then at one point it breaks and he has to go in. He has to do something. But it does make me wonder, was this planned for that night or was this someday when the moment's right, when it strikes, I'm going to strike. And I wonder if this just happened to be the night that he just couldn't hold it back and chose to go in and then is utterly shocked that there's all these other people in there. Okay, I'm assuming he thought Xana was sleeping. And I don't think he anticipated Kaylee being there. Right. And I think that plays out a bit too in what we've later learned now about the brutality of all of this.
Yeah. And the brutality of it really kind of struck me as well when we're trying to identify this arc of his, because the one thing I wasn't really seeing until we've seen some deeper dives and some releases is that arc. And Howard alluded to it as well. Mm-hmm. And his arc is the rage arc.
Yeah.
And even though he didn't do anything as violent as this, there was a rage arc. And so here's my conjecture. He went out there with the intention of, I'm going to eventually do this mm-hmm. because I want to experience this because of the emotional need and whatever fantasy, you know, whatever he wanted to do to impress people, all that we've talked about. But I think as he's going through and being that teaching assistant, and it's ramping up, that anger and rage is ramping up because he's not being recognized. He's being, you know, turned in for being creepy. He's getting counseled. He's almost being thrown out of the program. It kind of reached that crescendo as he's already stalking this area because he's identified the house. He's identified people in the house. And then all of a sudden we have this snap moment. He's like, his anger and rage bubbled over. So he then was ready to start executing mm-hmm. This is the execution. That's why the brutality, especially with the first victim, a 70 stab wounds.
It's high.
That is rage pure, unadulterated rage. And so that was, it's got to come from somewhere. And that was the escalation. It was a rage escalation, I think, was probably coming from his time as being a teaching assistant and also being lambasted and sucking at that.
Well, and sucking at this too. I mean, literally, yeah. I think he went, my guess is he went in thinking he was going to get to Maddie. And he was going to, there's going to be an essay and he was going to kill her. Or I don't even know, maybe not even kill, maybe just that and get out and be masked and get away. But he gets confronted by all of these other people. And even that, even the plan he had gets screwed up. And I could, in a really, I can almost like picture it in like a movie type way where he goes in, he thinks he's going to do this. And all of a sudden, you know, just that look he has about him, that blank stare, like, oh my gosh, he's met with reality that wasn't exactly what he thought it was going to be. And he's like just going nuts. Just anybody who's in his way and they screwed it up. I feel like the excessive rage in this case was more so because even this plan he messed up. And so he just went to town, and I'm not trying to be crass or anything, but he just went crazy on these people because of that rage, because again, he was stopped and his plan went to shit. And why is that? Because these people were there, not because he shouldn't be in this house doing what he's doing, but because they got in his way. There's no other explanation, really.
And from the very beginning, I remember, you know, when we started covering this together 3 years ago, the first thing that struck me, and it's held true throughout this, is that he planned this as if this was a final in high school, and he's a student and he's going to execute this, and his supreme arrogance was his undoing the entire time because he failed this exam and he could not, this guy thankfully could not innovate.
Yeah.
He could not take something new, take a new data. And as much as he thinks he's so smart and great, as Olivia was saying, he's a horrible student. He's the worst student there possibly is because he didn't learn a thing outside of the stovepipe of what he thought reality was. And he thought this stovepipe in which he saw the world was it. And he's completely right. And everyone else is an idiot.
Yeah.
Which, as tragic as this is, I still think had he been a better student, this would, he would not have made the mistakes and this might've continued to go on.
Oh, we also learned how sloppy he was as well. There's Tinder messages out there now, and this would have been big as evidence had this gone to court, connected to Koberger, where allegedly he's mentioning K-bar knives and dark fantasies of like, what's the worst way to die? You know, like people talk about on Tinder.
And doing it on that Facebook page as well.
This is just how screwed up his mind is in terms of like, oh yeah, go on Tinder. People are looking for that. They're looking to find a partner. They're looking to hook up. They're not looking to chat about K-bar knives and the worst way to die. But Koberger thinks that's going to be the calling card to get some.
You know, here's something I hadn't thought of before, but when you're talking about that on Tinder, it really made me think that there was a voice some time ago. I actually looked up the stats on this, and it's true. And here's what true. I don't remember the exact numbers, but the number of people and by gender that are into true crime, it's vastly dominant on the female side. Females are definitely much more into true crime stories and stories like this than males definitely are. And I really wonder if part of his motivation was that.
How
and
so?
Maybe trying to, you know, so he's kind of talking on these forums. He's on the Facebook page that was created around this case and Tinder. And he's on these forums trying to you know, share his expertise and get these thoughts and opinions. And who's he interacted with for predominantly on these sites?
Women.
Women.
Yeah. Well, because look at his attorney team. I mean, I didn't know that he had a whole lot of choice in that matter, but yeah, he's, I thought it was funny.
I know I'm on the way out on the conjecture thing on that one, but it's just since you brought up Tinder on it and what he was posting, it's like, you know, it's the only time I'm thinking about it. It's the only time where he's actually having an interaction with a female that actually might've been halfway interested in the things he was saying.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because he has this rage for women and he's being represented by all women.
Who did not look happy in the courtroom with him at sentencing.
Oh my God. There was like Ann Koberger used to be, or not Ann Koberger, Ann Taylor.
I always forget her name.
Ann Taylor. She was visibly like, I'm sitting a little bit further away from this guy this time. Like he's not there. It wasn't like it was in the hearings.
No, I felt for them.
Yeah.
To a degree.
They did their job, without a doubt.
It felt like shame was just leaking out of them.
Oh my God.
And I don't know who the assistant attorney is on Koberger's left.
Yeah.
But I saw her smirk when Olivia started talking and Steve Gonsalves started talking.
I did too.
Could have just been me trying to see what wasn't there, but I was watching them when they were eviscerating him, and Anne was, again, she kept her head down most of the time.
I thought I got a little nod or two out of Anne when Olivia was letting him have it.
Yeah,
like, especially when they were talking about like prison justice. I swear to I could be wrong. I was watching it, you know, in real time. Oh, and I think I saw a little bit of, yeah, please take him off this planet.
Oh, it was really good.
Because, I mean, I can't imagine, like, I asked Bob Mata this the other day, defense attorney. I said, Bob, what is she thinking right now in that courtroom from a defense attorney standpoint? Yeah. And he said, I know exactly what she's thinking. I saved my client's life, and I did my job.
Right.
And she did. That was her job. She succeeded at doing her job. The question at the end of the day is, okay, yes, but you're a human being too, and you're hearing all of this horror that your client that you so, you know, desperately saved the life of did these horrible things. Do you feel good about yourself? I mean, it's your job. That's why we have defense attorneys. I mean, I'm not against defense attorneys, but, you know, I guess that comes with the territory in something like this.
I've never done a deep dive on this, and I'm sorry when dealing with Ann Taylor. She wasn't court appointed, was she? She was court appointed.
Right? She was court appointed.
Yeah. Okay.
She was the only one of the. And the issue with it was because there was very few death penalty qualified appointed attorneys.
Remember that.
In the state, and she was one of them, and that's who she got.
Hey, because the only reason I asked because I was curious. Like she did a really good job for court appointed.
Oh. But she's to be a death penalty qualified attorney, you're going to get a good one. You know, it's not a speeding a petty crime or something. So you're getting
a hard job for her, huh?
Yeah, you get the best of the best there. But yeah, I mean, I would feel, I don't know. I would think I'd be bathing in Purell for days after all of that, because it was just so, so extreme.
You definitely got to believe in the law more than you believe in people, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's good. They're out there. As much as it's like, I mean, there's wrong.
You have those ones that represented, Richard Allen, Delphi.
Exactly. Exactly. You have, people that are wrongly convicted. Obviously that's not the case.
Not the case here. Oh my gosh.
So here's a terrifying reality we are left with. Brian Koberger didn't just show up one night with a knife and a grudge. He showed up with a blueprint. And that blueprint may have been drawn weeks in advance, stitched together through long walks past windows, phone pings in the dark, door loosened just enough to test boundaries, and late night parking lot loops that now look less like coincidence and more like dry runs. And yet, even with all that planning, it wasn't control that defined his crime, it was chaos. Because Koberger may have mapped the house, he may have stalked the targets, but once inside, the fantasy crumbled. Victims he likely didn't expect were awake. People he didn't anticipate were home. And in that moment, what had been precision turned into panic. Rage filled the cracks where control fell apart. Robin nailed something critical here. This wasn't just a kill, it was an emotional detonation. The brutality wasn't random. It was the result of everything that led up to it. The perceived slights, the academic failures, the ego bruises, the stalking that didn't deliver the power he hoped for. It all exploded that night. And the result was carnage far worse than he might have ever envisioned. And we also learned something else, something deeply disturbing about how Koberger sees the world. from the Tinder chats about K-bar knives to his obsessive need to be seen as an intellectual authority. It's clear he believed his fantasy life made him superior, that his darkness gave him depth, that his violence would make him unforgettable. But when what the Gonzalez family, the public, and the evidence are making clear now is this: Koberger isn't unforgettable. He's pathetic. He didn't master anything. He failed at literally everything. And now, as we connect the dots between fantasy, surveillance, and sheer incompetence, we're left not with the legend he might have hoped for, but with a case study in how delusion collapses under reality. More unsealed files are on the way, and you can bet we'll be here breaking down every one of them. Tell me what your thoughts are in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, please join us. Check us out there. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us there. And if you're not on the podcast platforms, do the same search over there on Apple Podcasts, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you will find us. Hit subscribe so you don't miss any of our content. We do greatly, greatly appreciate that. And let us know, like I said, in the comments, what are your thoughts? Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.